on the investment. Yeah.
Right. I mean, exactly. I don't see this any other way. I mean, I know you're trying to be more conservative with your numbers, but I mean, I see this as literally like infinity investment. Unless you have another plan for evolving taxes.
Welcome to Real Estate Hackers, where you'll hear how real estate investors grew something from nothing.
Property management is going to become more techy. Our entire business today is based off of a hack. What if you could put $1,000 into an apartment building project on your phone?
With YouTube, with podcasts, you can catch up very quickly to a seasoned investor.
Now here's your real estate hacker host, Chad Gallagher.
So who are you guys? What the heck are you guys doing? Where are you from?
Yeah, so ARC is American Revitalization Company, and our focus was born out of the omnibus bill. So our team has been in the conservation easement space now for the better part of a decade, put together close to 30 different projects on tracts of land that were conserved in that space. And you may not know this, but the tax laws around the charitable deductions that people get for conserving land or historic buildings is the same tax code. And so back, you know, going back to 16, the IRS started challenging these conservations or preservations on historic buildings. It didn't matter if it was a historic building or raw land that was being conserved. The IRS didn't like it if unrelated parties got together and started doing this. So they put together what's called a listing notice, and they started attacking every one of these transactions, auditing them, tying people up in court, and just making it generally undesirable to be in that space, or, you know, doing their best to do so. And then, you know, through kind of some different iterations, a couple of different bills were proposed. And then, you know, finally they passed a bipartisan piece in the omnibus bill at the end of last year that kind of changed the landscape quite a bit. They took away the ability for you and I, let's say, to go do a conservation easement together. And they put all these kind of guardrails around the multiples, you know, so if I invest a dollar, you know, I can legally only take a $2.50 tax deduction now, and whereas in the past it was solely based on what we could value that land at. So we look at things through the eyes of a developer, right? If I take a piece of land, whether it's a building in Lancaster or 100 acres of farmland out in rural North Carolina, you know, what's the highest and best use for that land? What can I do with it, right? And that's how the government looks at it. You know, when you go to court and you defend these things, it's always going to come down to that valuation. If I'm saying, you know, I'm going to take 1,000 acres in the desert of Nevada and I'm going to build Disneyland on it, you're probably not realistic, right? But so there's some guardrails to kind of how this all works and kind of the court cases and precedent that's been established. And as long as you stay within that, it's generally been, you know, fairly straightforward, and you don't have a whole lot to worry about. You know, in fact, the Treasury actually was the one that stepped in at the end of the year and said, hey, you know, not only has the IRS been abusive with their attacks of these things, but they didn't even follow the Administrative Procedures Act when they put this listing notice in place. So it was actually thrown out by the Treasury courts. So that kind of opened up, you know, the doors once we got rid of that, because that's what CPAs hated about it, is they can't recommend a listed transaction to their clients because it was a little too risky for them. And then the second part of what happened was the omnibus bill. And what the omnibus bill did is it put all these guardrails and limitations in place on conserving open space or green land, but they specifically carved out and set aside historical buildings and said, we're not affecting the law on this at all, and we're not changing it whatsoever. So all these new rules don't apply to historic buildings. And so based on that, we made a clear decision, you know, that was the direction we wanted to head, because we see better, you know, better economics there on the historical side. And, you know, quite frankly, I mean, you know, raw land is getting harder and harder to come by these days. And so a lot of the land that can be conserved has been conserved. And so that's kind of how we shifted and created ARC. And, you know, the focus is, you know, we have to take these historic buildings. We have to determine what the highest and best use, what, you know, what could you develop on this, whether it's knocking the building down or building on top of it, you know, building around it. And you got to come up with what that value would be, just like a developer would do. And then based on whatever the lost opportunity is for that project, that's what our investor's tax deduction is based on. So hypothetically, if a building would value out at $100 million once it was stabilized and it would cost me $50 million to build it, well, my investors would receive a $50 million tax deduction. And that's probably not far off of what the Lancaster project looks like fundamentally, just because Lancaster is a booming, you know, retirement community right now.
There's also something to be said for its need to be able to work with these old historic buildings. Like, you know, the building that we're talking about in Lancaster, I'm sure you've driven by it. It's these beautiful old buildings that we're getting the chance to preserve and really work with.
It's a post office building, the old post office building in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's an old, you know, 65,000, 70,000 square foot granite building, beautiful architecture, an asset that likely wouldn't make it in kind of the modern world if it wasn't protected. And so by permanently putting a deed of preservation on that building, the facade of that building can never be altered. We just look at what's the cost to take this property from where it is today to that. Right? That 30-story luxury high-rise senior living, right? What does it cost me to get there? And then we do market studies and we have third-party appraisers that come in and say, well, if you built this, this is what it's going to value at. Here's the comps, here's the discounted cash flow model on the valuations, and they just back into the numbers. And so between all of our costs and the purchase of the building, we're probably going to be all in around $10 million. And we expect that to generate anywhere between a $25 and $40 million tax deduction to our investors.
Now that tax deduction would offset other passive gains, or I guess if you're a real estate investor, could offset W-2 income. But if you're just a W-2.
Well, here's the great thing about it. Because of the section of the tax code that this is in, it's actually classified as a charitable deduction. So anybody can invest in our fund and get a charitable deduction that will offset up to 50% of their AGI. So most charitable deductions are limited to 30% of your AGI. And this section of the tax code allows it for 50%. And the other thing that's unique about this part of the tax code is it actually allows the carry forward for 15 years instead of 5. Wow. So we can offset all forms of income. A lot of our investors are, W-2 tech workers from Silicon Valley and things of that nature. We do get a lot of entrepreneurs that invest as well. And, the perfect utilization of the fund is somebody who has a perfect blend of ordinary income and capital gains income, because charitable deductions offset your highest taxable income first. So if I got a guy that's got $500,000 of ordinary and $500,000 of capital gains, right, we're going to be able to offset all of his ordinary income at the higher rate, and he's only going to pay taxes on the $500,000 of capital gains.
So just to round out the example, I think I got my head around it. So I put in $100K into your fund. It's not crazy for me to expect a $250K tax write-off, which could go against my highest taxable income. If I'm making $500K a year, you know, I could write $250K off. My tax savings on that's going to be about $100K, give or take what state you live in.
Yep.
And so I'm basically in the investment for free.
Exactly. Yeah, it's kind of the found money concept, right? We're taking your tax dollars and we're buying, income producing assets, and we are going to cap that deduction at $2.50 to every dollar invested, just because legally there's no requirement to do that. The code allows us to take the full value of any of these appraised valuations, but the IRS has been very vocal and very clear that if you stay at or below that threshold, they're not going to harass you. And they've even made motions to dismiss in court around that. So we feel pretty good that by staying under that $2.50 or 2.5 multiple on your tax deductions, that it's going to really lower the risk profile from an audit perspective with the IRS. And that's what most of our CPAs and investors are looking for, right? They're looking for something that they can feel comfortable about recommending to their clients.
That's great. So then, as I understand this right, you have to hold the asset for 5 years.
Right.
And then, so after 5 years, you would probably sell the property?
That's right. Yeah. So the fund will have about a 5.5 year life. We will liquidate all the holdings, the real estate and the businesses will get liquidated at the beginning of the 5 year period. And so, the idea here is that we will generate a preferred return. So the fund is structured with a 7% cumulative preferred return to the investors before the 80-20 split of the profits. And that's 80% to the investors and 20% to the manager.
Yeah, super fair.
And then once we return, not counting any tax benefits, but once we return 100% of your invested capital, it flips to 80-20 manager. So our incentive and our focus is on the back end. If we don't perform and execute on the assets, we're not going to make a lot of money. But if we do perform and execute, then it's going to be about a 50-50 split over the life of the fund between the investors and the manager.
And I mean, it's weird. Normally you do like an expected IRR. I guess without tax benefits, your expected IRR is probably okay. 9%,
yeah.
Something like that. But kind of what you're telling me, if I'm doing the math right. But then you're like, with your tax benefits, the IRR goes to like blank over zero, which you can't even do. It's like it's infinity. I mean, you probably can't calculate the IRR.
Yeah, no, it's in the upper 40s. Yeah, so high single digits, low double digits without the tax benefits, and then when you add them in, it's definitely up in that high 40s.
But I mean, I'm not crazy to think that if you're getting that tax deduction year one, you put in 100, you get a 250K tax deduction. As I see it, that was money going to the IRS. As I see that,
like the opportunity cost is paying taxes on the investment. Yeah. Right.
I mean, exactly. I don't see this any other way. I mean, I know you're trying to be more conservative with your numbers, but I mean, I see this as literally like infinity investment. Unless you have another plan for evolving taxes. This is really
fun. I'm glad you see it that way. And one of the really interesting aspects of this, Chad, is that if you're an entrepreneur, right, if you're running your own business, you're typically paying quarterly estimated taxes. So I can make this investment in January, February, March, and have my CPA alter my quarterly estimates based on the charitable deduction. So I don't even have to wait, 12 months to recover this from the IRS like a W-2 employee would. I can have an immediate equalization of my tax payments.
That's great.
Our investment minimum is 100K, have to be an accredited investor. So those are really the qualifications. And our average ticket right now is about 250, 275 grand.
Cool. And how big of a fund are you guys raising?
So we legally set the limit of the fund at 100 million. However, we think we're probably with the three assets that we have under contract, we're probably targeting about a $40 million raise. And we're probably about 10 to 15% into that right now.
And then like the idea is to raise it all this year? Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah. It has to all be done in a calendar year. We have to shut off the fundraising probably by the end of, middle to end of October, maybe into the first couple of weeks in November, in order to close all the assets and file the deed of preservation in this calendar year for the tax benefits.
Cool. And you guys are based in Missouri?
No. So the headquarters is in Nashville. My partners are all based out of Birmingham, Alabama. We have a couple people up in the Nashville area, northern Alabama, southern Tennessee. And then I'm actually out in the Bay Area in California.
We host an event here in Lancaster for real estate investors. We get about 100 people to come out. When you're in town at some point, someone who's like a partner or who knows what they're talking about, we should have you, I can tell you the dates, we should definitely have you come speak.
That'd be great. Would love to.
It's like a super innovative, you're the first person, I know a lot about tax deductions. This historic tax credit definitely went under the radar. I mean, I don't really know anyone talking about it. It seems like when the word, at some point, this is going to increase the value of those assets because
there's a lot of ways to skin the cat, Chad. We don't have to buy an asset outright, so we can even partner with a lot of your listeners and members, and we have developers that are we're buying the air rights to preserve the building, so we buy the development rights to the building just like people would in New York City or Miami, right? You could sell your development rights off. And so we can buy that. You can maintain, or your client or listener can maintain ownership of the asset, and they just give up those development rights in the future. And so we can work deals out that way. You know, we have a couple folks right now looking at doing a 1031 into a historic asset where, you know, they would hold it for the year and the day holding period, and then do the charitable, they would do the deed of preservation next year, right? So you got a guy who's doing a 1031 on a building, but he's got a substantial taxable income. You know, we can take a tax deduction for him in, you know, after a year and a day. And so there's a lot of different ways to kind of utilize this tool. We have CPAs using it for Roth conversions with clients, you know, dealing with RSUs and stock options and things like that. So there's a lot of different ways to utilize the fund.
So like, you could go into someone who owns a building that's historic and say, hey, we'll buy your air rights. You don't even own the building.
Yeah.
Do nothing with the air rights, and then use the air rights as a tax write-off, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically everything is still the same. We still do all the same due diligence, same, you know, project management to make sure we validate what the tax deduction is, but we don't actually have to own the asset. We prefer to, but we don't have to.
Yeah.
And so we can come up with a structure where the property owner gets a capital infusion, which they do whatever they want with it. A lot of the guys that we're talking to are doing the actual renovations of these historic assets. So they need a bridge loan, which they typically go to a bank and pay a high interest rate on to do the construction before they can capture the historical tax credits coming back from the federal and state programs. So if we can do an air rights deal and permanently preserve that historic building,
we'll give them the money.
Exactly. So we become their bridge loan, and they don't pay interest. They love it. And the other thing you're doing is, you know, the state historic preservation offices love it too, because now they're locking in that building. They're getting the historic renovation on the building, and they're getting the historic deed of preservation on the building. So they know.
For 5 years, is it locked in, or is it locked in longer?
It's locked in. So with the renovation credits, it's locked in for 5 years. But when you do the deed of preservation, that building's permanently protected.
So like the building you're doing in Lancaster, will that building be permanently protected?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We're buying that whole asset. We're going to own the asset. Our investors will participate in that asset, and we will permanently protect that building, so it'll never be changed.
When you sell it in 5.5 years, it will sell as a historic building that must stay within this
yep.
use. No one can.
It'll always be the 70,000, you know, footprint envelope that it is today. You'll never be able to change the exterior facade of the building. You can do whatever you want to the interior. You can change uses of the interior. You're just not going to be permitted to destroy the architectural, you know, character of the building.
Yeah. Super cool, Steve. Are there a bunch of folks like you out there right now, or are you guys like one of the few?
No, there's really nobody that we see out there kind of doing what we are doing. I'm sure there are some people doing it. We just haven't run across them yet. And, you know, at the end of the day, we feel like we have a really unique strategy, and we're only talking about the real estate side. There's a whole, you know, manufacturing play where we take all the excess cash, because we're capping those tax deductions at 2.5 to 1, whatever excess cash is left over after all the real estate is done at the end of the year, we're going to go out and buy some legacy, you know, industrial manufacturing companies and help, you know, maintain those jobs here in the United States, make sure they're not going overseas, and help rebuild the American manufacturing sector. And so that's going to create another tax play on the exit of the fund as well.
I'm curious, what constitutes a historic building? What's the...
When it comes to our program, doing the preservation, the deed of preservation, the thing that constitutes a historic building is that it's already on the National Park Service's registry. So it can be individually protected, or it can be part of a listed historic district on the registry as a contributing property. And ultimately, the Park Service has 4 criteria to determine, you know, if a building's qualified. The preliminary is it has to be at least 50 years old, right? And then they look at the materials and the architecture. They look at, you know, is there any kind of event-driven historical significance to the building? They look at, historical figures, right? You know, did Thomas Jefferson, you know, have lunch at this building every Tuesday for you know, most of his life or something to that, you know, was a famous treaty or something signed at this building, right? So those are the primary three that get most assets onto the registry. The fourth is archaeological. And so obviously we stay away from archaeological for obvious reasons because you can't really alter those sites. And generally speaking, if you can add 100 to 150,000 square feet to the current building, it's generally going to pencil out for our investors. So that's kind of our initial litmus test, if you would.
Do you have a hard time explaining this to high net worth individuals who don't?
Not really. No. I mean, you know, most people get it pretty quickly that it's kind of the found money concept that you're kind of trading tax dollars for, you know, performing assets and whether or not you believe in kind of the mission of preserving these kind of historic downtowns and these, you know, kind of legacy manufacturing companies, you know, people generally agree with that thesis, regardless of kind of your political beliefs. They kind of agree with kind of preserving, you know, these parts of America. But people love the tax benefits initially, but then they really dig in. You know, what we've seen is they really tend to dig into kind of the nature of what we're doing and why we're doing it. And that really kind of gets people on board pretty quickly.
Are you able to add stuff to this registry, or is that like impossible? Like you said.
Oh, yeah. And anybody can add properties. There's currently about 1.8 million properties nationwide on the registry. And, you know, I'll give you an example. We found a really good asset down in Miami, right kind of in the downtown sector of Miami. And it's a historic building at the local level. It's just never been placed on the registry. So we'll work with a partner to go through the process. It takes anywhere from 3 to 6 months to get a building on the registry.
Really awesome. We haven't talked too much about the manufacturing side. Maybe just comments a little deeper on that. So this is like more on the tail end of the fund. You're looking to actually go buy manufacturing plants that are distressed. Do I have that right?
Not distressed. So we're really looking for, you know, your typical baby boomer, somebody who doesn't have a succession plan in place. And, you know, they haven't shut the business down because it's a vital business to their community. They have a lot of long-term employees. You know, it's not uncommon to see, you know, employees that have been with them for 10, 15, 20 years. And, you know, they live, you know, they've made their money. They're quasi-retired. They're kind of semi-remotely running the businesses. They just don't want to lay off their people. And so there's a lot of those stories out there throughout America right now. And, you know, I was lucky to be part of a, you know, kind of a traditional private equity roll-up fund going out and acquiring those businesses. So I saw, you know, I sat in the rooms with these guys and I heard their stories, and they're just incredible, you know, incredible businesses that have been very profitable, very successful. And the reason we like them is, you know, there are a lot of them out there and there's a lot to weed through to get to the good ones, of course. But if you know what to look for and you know the right stories, then you know, you can buy very good, successful businesses that have a lot of upside and very little downside. And there's a huge trend right now of kind of reshoring manufacturing after kind of the, you know, what everybody lived through during the supply chain disruptions a couple of years ago. We're buying businesses that have really strong balance sheets, but also really strong incomes, right? So targeting like 1 to 3 million for most of the portfolio is really kind of where we're at.
And how's that? And then, so basically the tax benefit is you're basically doing essentially a cost segregation study. Am I thinking about that right?
We will use cost seg on any of the real estate assets that we own, but the real tax benefits on these businesses are going to come from the exit strategy. So we might buy, like I said, 2 to 5 companies and kind of meld them together into one company. So you're naturally going to get some cost control, right? Because if I'm buying, you know, 3, 4, 5 companies that are all in similar fields, have kind of tangential businesses, maybe they have some client overlaps, I'm going to reduce overhead on IT and finance and HR and all of those natural cost savings that you get from consolidation. That's going to go straight to the bottom line. But then I'm also going from a company doing 1 or 1.5 million of EBITDA to a diversified group of companies that's doing 4, 5, 6, 7 million of EBITDA. So when I get the multiplier up. Yeah. So when I go to exit that, I'm going to get a higher multiple on the back end is kind of the thesis. And we've seen that pretty consistently in the marketplace.
Got it. So it's less about tax savings for that strategy.
Well,
like a private equity play.
It is a traditional private equity strategy, but the exit is a little bit unique. What we're doing on the exit is a tax play. So we're going to actually sell the business back to the employees through what's called an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan. So at the omnibus bill, part of the Secure Act 2.0, Congress set aside a budget to really start kind of pushing this agenda of transferring equity to employees more, right? So ESOPs have been around for a long, long time. They've been used very successfully by companies like Wawa. Wawa is an ESOP company. Really what you're doing is you're selling 100% of the company to the employee's retirement plan so that the company becomes tax exempt. And so the banks and insurance companies, they come in and they finance that as kind of like a leveraged ESOP, right? But what happens for our investors is each investor individually gets to make their own election of what's called a 1042. And you guys obviously know a 1031 in real estate where you exchange and defer the tax. 1042 is the same thing, but when you sell your company to an ESOP, the replacement property isn't another private company, it's any US stock or bond, right? So you got an investor who puts in 100 grand. Let's say we take 50 of that 100 grand and we go buy these businesses. And let's just for the sake of this conversation, say we double the exit value, right? So we go from 50 grand to 100 grand on the exit, coming back to the investor. They can pay zero taxes on that 100 grand if they simply take it and put it into a brokerage account and buy US stocks or bonds. And there's no definitive timeline. They can defer that until death and get a step up in basis.
So is that's all coupled into this one fund you're doing?
Yes, correct.
So it'll be a mix. So will it be 2.5 times the tax write-off right away, or will it be a mix of these two different tax kind of?
No, so you'll get your 2.5 to 1 maximum deduction. We won't go over that. But you're going to have some other assets that you own inside of the fund and you know, whether they're paid for with cash or some combination of cash and debt, like you suggested, we're going to generate as much income in the fund as we can to our investors.
There could be some additional down the road, basically these like manufacturing tax breaks that allow you to get the money back essentially tax-free.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we want to take advantage of, everything we can. So like you suggested CostEgg, that's a great way to drive, tax benefits. The manufacturing companies are going to be eligible for a lot of R&D credits. If we put renewable energy on the buildings, we'll get a lot of renewable energy ITC credits that we can pass through to offset some of the operating income. So we pretty much look at everything we can do to enhance the value of the portfolio, whether it's real estate or businesses. We have a pretty sophisticated approach in all of that, but it's really at the end of the day, we're going to provide, assets, we're taking your tax dollars, number one, and we're providing you income producing assets that we believe are going to appreciate nicely. Okay. And then we're going to do everything we can over that 5.5 year hold period to mitigate our taxes and make sure that we're being as tax efficient as we can with operating these assets.
Cool, guys. Well, I'm sure I'll send you some emails and more questions, but I really appreciate you joining. And
love to hear more about your in-person events. I'd be happy to come out and speak and meet any of your partners that you got out there.
Oh, hey, how should people contact you?
Great. So you can either go to the website or we can we have investors@arclp.fund is our investor email box, which gets monitored by the whole team. So we have about a 7-person capital markets team headed by Zach Murphy, who's our president of capital markets. And Zach's actually on his honeymoon right now. But so investors@arclp.fund. And, we also have the ability for anybody to just go to the website and get access to the investor portal. It is a 506C, so it's a public offering.
Awesome, guys. Hey, have a great weekend.
You too, Chad. Thanks.
Great to meet you.
Thanks for listening to this edition of the Real Estate Hackers Show. If you've not yet become a member of Real Estate Hackers, you can do that for free at realestatehackers.com. Get access to all the amazing real estate hacker deals, from incredible vendors, a ton of content and materials for you, the investor. You can follow Real Estate Hackers on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. If you can give us a 5-star review for the podcast, I would personally really appreciate it. We read every review, and thank you so much for helping us grow this community for you, the real estate investor.